how she wanted to. This new group of humans I was opening up to were teaching me so much about how to be in the world, how to live my own truth, and to honour my authentic self. It was a level of radical self-acceptance I'd never seen before, and while I'd always been self-assured and not prone to giving a fuck what other people thought, this was the first time I had been surrounded by other people who lived their lives that way too. It was inspiring, empowering, and fulfilling, things I'd lacked in friendship circles for some time. We went out to a netball game one night, me, her, and two of her friends who knew about us. I bought a new outfit, jeans and a cute top, because I wanted to keep it casual but also do enough to maintain her attention. And I did my hair and makeup immaculately. I wanted to look hot for her. Somehow, despite being in the public eye, it all still felt so normal. And I liked it. We all went back to her place for dinner after the game. We walked into the lounge room, her friends tagging along a few paces behind, and she grabbed me and kissed me hard. "I have been wanting to do that all day," she smiled as she pulled her mouth away from mine. "Guess the new outfit must have paid off." After we ate, we cuddled up together under a blanket on the couch, watching a movie with her friends. It scared me a bit just how normal this all felt, how right, even knowing my life was back at home. Only a couple of weeks earlier, I'd never even touched a girl, let alone kissed one. Now all of a sudden, I was snuggled under a doona with this woman at her home, holding hands and kissing like this was real life. It felt like I had arrived, like this was truly me, who I was meant to be. The end of the night came, her friends left, and the conversation turned to us having sex. It was pretty clear by that point that it was going to happen, and we discussed it very openly. I wanted her, even though I was still beyond nervous about the idea of being with a woman. But she wouldn't do it. Not that night. "Your first time with a woman is a really big deal, Soph," she told me. "I want you to enjoy it. I want you to be present." I loved that about her. I mean, I was totally sexually frustrated at this point because I really wanted this, but I couldn't fault her for wanting to make sure the experience was amazing for me, for wanting to ensure I was comfortable and relaxed and feeling good. This woman was amazing, and I was completely besotted with her. To me, she was perfect. Although I must admit, as much as I wanted to sleep with her, the thought of having sex with a woman, of me touching a woman, did still petrify me. I didn't think I was going to like a vagina. I liked penises, right? And I was very good at what I did with men. What if I'm bad at sex with a girl? What if I go down on her and I don't like it? It was a problem for another day, something future Sophie would have to figure out. I left that night, sexually unsatisfied, but more in love with the idea of this woman and I together. Jared and our son Bobby's birthdays are a week apart, and every year I'd fly them both up to the Gold Coast for a father-son weekend together. They'd go to Movie World, hang out and have fun, just the boys, and it meant I had the house to myself for a couple of nights. So I invited her over, ostensibly for dinner, but we both knew what was on the agenda. Jared knew, too. I wasn't trying to do the sneaky on him. He knew perfectly well what I had planned for the weekend, and he indicated his full approval. She was free, so we locked it in, and the week leading up to it was the longest week of my life. I was counting down the minutes. I was just so excited, but I was terrified as well. I was about to have a girl over, have dinner, and have sex with her. What the fuck was going on? I definitely blocked out a lot of the emotions because I knew if I was consciously engaged in them too much, the reality of what was happening would become too real for me. Finally, the night arrived. It was like a date. I heard the knock on my door, raced down to find her standing there, bottle of red wine in hand. I was so fucking nervous. We ordered Vietnamese takeaway and sat on the couch, talking and laughing, giving flirty touches. I couldn't get out of my head. It was so normal, but also so weird for me. My thoughts were giving me mental whiplash and confusion plagued me. How could I be here, enjoying myself this much, with her? I'm straight. Why do I like this? But I am fucking loving this. There was something about the fact that she was a woman. It was more than just a sexual connection, which I'd felt with men in the past, that I felt with my husband. It was comfort. It was a sense of relatability. It was feeling like I could really be me, fully, deeply, authentically me. Even though I had a beautiful man who loved and accepted every part of me, every conversation with this woman, every moment, every touch, was teaching me more about myself than I ever knew before. We'd had a few wines with dinner, but we weren't drunk, not even close. And the pressure of what lay ahead of us weighed on me. I couldn't just outright ask her to come up to the bedroom. It didn't feel right, and this meant so much to me. But fuck, we had to go upstairs to the bedroom at some point. We'd been watching Free to Air and wanted to put on a movie, but Netflix wasn't working on the TV downstairs, so we needed to go up to my bedroom. I swear to God this wasn't a ploy, but it sure fucking sounded like it. I was mortified at how set up this whole thing looked. "You're going to think I'm lying, but Netflix doesn't actually work down here," I said nervously, "so we'll have to go upstairs." I don't know why I freaked out about asking her to the bedroom. It's what we'd planned, how we'd already determined the night would go when we'd spoken about it the week before. She'd come over, we'd have wine, we'd put a movie on, and we'd just take it from there. But suddenly I was a teenager, forgetting everything I'd ever known, rattled with nerves about the unknown I was about to dive into. "I want you to know that this is not about me tonight," she told me during one of our planning calls. "I'm going to make it all about you as the first step. Don't feel any pressure to touch me, to do anything. I just want you to feel comfortable and confident first, and then we'll take it from there. No expectations." I led her to the room I shared with my husband and sat on the bed. She was uncomfortable. "Jared sleeps here," she reminded me, as if I wasn't already acutely aware. But there wasn't anywhere else to go. "Well, I don't really feel like having sex with you on my son's bunk beds," I laughed nervously. "Don't overthink it. We're just going to watch a movie." "Take your own advice, Soph. Don't overthink it." But how could I not? I'd never been nervous sexually before, but then I'd never experienced touching, affection, this level of physical intimacy with a woman either. For the first time in so long, a sexual experience was foreign to me. Suddenly, I was a virgin again at 27. "Are you okay?" she asked. I was shaking. "I'm fine, I promise. Just nervous." I'd never even seen a vagina that wasn't my own, not in this sense anyway. A confronting reality, to be honest, and one I didn't know how I was going to react to. I wasn't used to feeling this vulnerable and nervous, and even though my nerves were totally understandable, I was still petrified that she'd be able to tell. I love sex. I am good at sex. I love exploring and trying new things, and having been with the same person for nearly 8 years, I'd become accustomed to feeling self-assured in the bedroom. But this was something new, a woman. It was her, and the confidence I usually felt wouldn't come. Thanks to my nerves, it took a long time for it to actually happen. I loved kissing her, and I was getting so turned on while we were making out. But the second she put her hand on me, I'd freeze. I don't know why. It definitely wasn't because I didn't want her to. It was scarily new. I was shaking so much that she stopped more than once to check if I was okay. Was she making me uncomfortable? Did I want to stop? No. 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 "Absolutely not," I told her. "I'm just fucking nervous." She tried to put her hand down my pants a few times, and I'd felt physically sick with nerves. I nearly vomited. I had to sit up, and she called it at that point. "We can't do this. I can't do it." It just wasn't in her nature to allow anything to happen unless I was completely comfortable. I begged her to bear with me. It's what I desperately wanted. I was just so unsure of myself, so out of my comfort zone. I also faced another first that I hadn't even given much thought to. It wasn't just the physical act of having sex that was making me edgy. When I saw her naked, I instantly felt insecure about my body. I'd never felt ashamed of how I looked before. Never been self-conscious or embarrassed when I'd been with my husband or other men before him. But I quickly found that, with a woman, I began comparing myself. Oh my God, my boobs don't look like that. I've breastfed babies. Oh, my vagina looks different to hers. Oh, I've given birth twice. She's got no cellulite. Her legs are soft. Fuck, why are mine so prickly? She was this incredibly fit, athletic, muscular, toned superstar. And I was just feeling like some sloppy mum of two. I was damaged goods in comparison. So while my first time with a woman was beautiful, it also definitely uncovered a lot of insecurities for me. I tried to put it out of my mind, tried to focus on being present in the moment and everything that was happening. "Can I take your pants off?" she asked, always so respectful the whole way through. I nodded. She tugged at my jeans, slipping them over my hips. I was extremely turned on, and things had got pretty wet downstairs. She put her hand in between my thighs and moaned. "What? What's wrong?" I was shocked by the sound she'd let out. "My God, you're so fucking sexy." She was excited by the fact that I was so turned on. She hadn't even done anything yet, but feeling how aroused I was turning her on. It wasn't something I'd ever really experienced with a man. Guys would get all hot and turned on when you'd touch their dick, but with her, with girls in general, I later learnt, you get more pleasure from giving pleasure than receiving, and it's beautiful. "Can I please go down on you?" she asked, a pleading tone to her oh so respectful question, as if I was going to say no. That's what we were there for, right? That's what girl sex was, yeah? Experience has since taught me that there's much more to it than that, but then I smiled and nodded as she slowly made her way down my body. The soft, gentle, sensual touch of her tongue was blissful, not just because of the pleasure I was receiving, but because of how much she was enjoying doing it. This girl was having the time of her fucking life, and I wasn't even doing anything. If sex with a girl means I can just lay here and not do anything, I want to do it more. But the more I got into it, the more I wanted to reciprocate. "I think I want to touch you," I whispered as my confidence began to build. No, I'm fine. You don't have to." Me touching her had never been in the plan. I'd had some friends over earlier in the day for a pep talk, and I said to them that there was no way I was going to be able to touch her vagina with my mouth. Fuck no, I am not into it. I'm straight. But as I lay there with her mouth on me, I wanted to try. And I discovered very quickly how into it I was. A woman's vulva is, without a doubt, one of the most beautiful sights I've ever seen. As someone who lived with such a deep-seated insecurity about whether mine looked nice, someone who often asked herself, "Is the colour okay? Does it have a scent? Why is that bit longer than that part?" I instantly appreciated the female body from a refreshingly new perspective. Insecurity about female anatomy stems from what I believe is the lack of open conversations about those body parts when we are younger. Whilst all human body parts are unique in their own characteristics, women often place more pressure on themselves to have more symmetry down there than they do their eyebrows. Despite being in a marriage where I was loved and embraced, I undertook a labiaplasty after the birth of my second child, the rawness of my childhood insecurities spurring me on to have the surgery. The operation consists of a procedure to reduce the size of the labia minora, the flaps of skin on either side of the vaginal opening. I also had some internal tears and subsequent excess skin after childbirth that was also required to be removed, but the choice to have my vulva manipulated was purely cosmetic. I sit here now having come quite literally face to face with a diverse range of beautiful vaginas, incredibly disappointed in my decision not to embrace my given anatomy in the way she deserved. When we were both satisfied, we lay there into the early hours of the morning, cuddling and kissing. While I felt like I was losing my virginity for the second time, I couldn't wrap my head around how different it was in comparison to the drunken sexual experiences you have when you're younger and exploring for the first time. Being so present during such a powerful experience had been terrifying, yes, but magical. And looking back, I can't thank her enough for giving me that moment in the way that she did. I was aware, I was present, and I knew I felt like me. In hindsight, and after comparing it to my later experiences with women, it was probably a very generic night of sex for her. I laughed to myself and slightly cringed thinking about it. It must have been so bad for her, but I hold her in such high regard and appreciation that she allowed me to explore and experiment with my sexuality with her. It's quite ironic that I now look back to masturbating as a teenager and the fact that I'd experienced my first ever orgasm while watching girl-on-girl porn. It was something I would never have dreamed I'd experience, but something I intrinsically found appealing from a young age. The level of connection I've received during experiences with women is nothing like anything I've experienced with a man. I absolutely cannot fault Jared as a sexual partner. He was always incredibly generous and attentive in his own devotion to my pleasure. But with another woman, when two energies align, there's a level of relatability, a sameness, a collective understanding about the world and our position in it. That night changed my world forever. A week later, I was standing in the supermarket, looking around whilst waiting in the queue, and I noticed this tall blonde girl standing at the checkout. She had long legs, a gorgeous tan, her skin was glowing, and she had these little denim shorts on with a white tee. I wonder what her boobs look like under there. I wonder what her pussy looks like. God, Sophie, you're here to get bananas and apples and you're wondering what some girl's vagina looks like? What the fuck? For the past year, I hadn't been attracted to women in general. It was just her. This one random meeting and my blinkers were on. I wasn't gay. I wasn't. But after that night, after we'd had sex, I started to look differently at women as a collective. My curiosity now applied to all women. Considering the absolutely cataclysmic effect the first woman I was with had on my entire life, things with her ended incredibly abruptly. We kept hanging out after the night we'd had sex, our one and only time, by the way, so I guess it must have been terrible, but it was mostly in group situations, like at sporting games, things like that. There's a bit of a running joke amongst gay girls that you will always fall in love with the first girl you hook up with, but while it's a stereotype, it was actually true in this situation. And I believed I did. I actually thought I loved her. In the weeks after we'd slept together, she was relying on me for some emotional support around some career stuff she was going through, and I was happy to be that support for her. We were still very emotionally entangled after that night together and still speaking a lot on the phone. Everything seemed great, but while I had certainly pictured us together, I hadn't given a lot of thought to where this was heading. I was just going with it. As I was leaving her place one Sunday night after she'd cooked me dinner, we kissed at the door and she asked when she would see me again. "I'm actually pretty busy with work and the kids this week," I replied. I was very into this girl, but I still had a business and a household to run. "Oh, what, you don't have a lunch break for me?" "Yeah, of course. Give me a call Tuesday and we'll organise something." "Cool, I really want to see you," she said before kissing me goodbye again. The next morning, I got a message from her that I did not see coming. "Hey, I think we should end this. I just want to be friends." "I'm sorry, what?" Now look, I had to be okay with it. I was still married, after all. But what the fuck had happened after I'd left her place less than 12 hours earlier? She'd kissed me at the door. She'd asked to have lunch with me that week. Had pushed for it when I said it might be tricky with work. "What's wrong? I saw you yesterday," I typed back. "Nothing, Sophie. but you're married. We just need to be friends. This is going too far. Out of the blue, it felt like she was putting it all on me, implying that I was making the situation more than it was. I was being too much. That was a really disappointing thing because I quite simply didn't think that was fair. She had as much a part to play as I did, but was acting as if I was too full on, like it was just a bit of fun for her and I had taken it too far. I later found out that she had met someone else. Suspicion makes me wonder if she was seeing both of us at the same time. They ended up dating for a while, and whilst I wasn't utterly heartbroken that we didn't end up together, I also didn't feel great that someone who had been involved in such a huge life experience for me would so abruptly pack up and leave. She would later tell me that the whole situation simply became too much for her. That was something I could have understood if she'd only told me. But my feelings were really hurt and I resented her after that. Part of me still does. As angry as I may have been, though, I can't ignore the most glaringly obvious fact. My entire life changed, thanks to her. Chapter 11. With Jared and I both having such high sex drives, our sex life was what we would both call very healthy. Like 5 or 6 times a week for roughly 8 years straight. There were never droughts or dry spells under our roof. Being active in the bedroom would always come naturally to us. But from the moment I had sex with a woman for the first time, my attraction to men, not just Jared, all men, began to decline. Rapidly. It didn't disappear completely, mind you, but it certainly diminished. It was women I craved. Women I would look at when I was out. Women I would think about when I was home alone too, in the shower, turned on. Jared could feel it too. He could sense it. One of my best friends, Georgie, told her mum, who's gay, about the kiss I'd shared with this woman outside the club that morning. "Tell Sophie to be careful," she told my friend, "because she won't go back." "Whatever, this is just fun. I love my husband." But she was insistent. If she genuinely wants her relationship with Jared to work out, she needs to stop this. And stop it now. At the time, I laughed it off. I was exploring, I was in my 20s, I was having a bit of fun. But she was right. Oh, she was right. It was horrific to accept, something I still struggle with to this day, the realization that my interest in my husband, this man who I still loved so dearly, was waning. People would say, "Well, that's the choice you made." And yeah, it is. But I was following my intuition. Did I ever, in my wildest dreams, think that sleeping with this woman as a life experience would result in me falling out of love with Jared? This sincere, attentive, loyal person, this devoted father of my children, who I thought was the sexiest man to walk this earth, with whom I shared the best relationship. Did I ever actually think that I'd fall out of love with him? No. Not for a second. But it wasn't as simple as that. I loved him, yes, so much. But there were things happening in our relationship at the same time, bubbling away beneath the surface that nobody knew about, not to mention a whole lot of shit happening within me that I was grappling with personally. So, whilst it's easy enough for people who are on the outside to look in and assume that we split up because I realized I liked women, and yes, absolutely, that was part of it, Jared knows, and I know, that we had other issues that we were contending with long before her. No one had done anything wrong or bad, but we'd been together since we were barely 20 years old, and that is really young in the context of life. We'd had a baby when he was 21 and I was 22. We got married at 24 and 25, had our second baby at 25 and 26. We'd done a hell of a lot in our 20s. Everyone thinks that because I have had multiple partners since we split, that it was me who called time on our relationship, but we mutually decided to separate. Jared was also in a marriage that he didn't want to be in, and he, too, felt a suffocating amount of pressure throughout this period. Do we intentionally seek out change? Or is it a naturally occurring part of life? You can easily argue both sides. But with any change comes ramifications, which have a snowball effect on our future. It's fair to assume that we'd all like change to be positive. Ideally, it would always take us to a place of higher value or deeper satisfaction. But that's not always the case. It's common to fear change, to fear the unknown. However, after going through the huge process I did, I can now look at it with nothing but acceptance. I can embrace it as a period in which your future is only just being created. Change, over the years, has allowed me to reveal unknown strengths, passions, and an entirely new version of myself I didn't know existed. Jared has, too. The process of change was something that, while not always easy, was relatively smooth as both our already open minds had readied us to be fluid in this situation. It was a natural progression of what we had always known in our lives together. I suffered horrific postnatal depression after Bobby was born, and it manifested as both social and separation anxiety. I couldn't be away from him, not even for a night. I was diagnosed with generalized anxiety disorder, characterized by irrational thoughts that if I went out anywhere, I would die, and Bobby would be left without a mum. I'd never felt the sense of both love and worry I experienced when I became a mum. Being so young, my only real concern in life prior to being responsible for someone's life was whether or not my uni assignment was going to be submitted on time or how long was left in my shift at work on a Sunday. I recall sitting with my mum at the doctor's office, one of the many times a family member had to take me in there themselves because I couldn't drive, and asking her, "When will I stop being so worried?" with a tear rolling down my face. "Never," she said. "You just get more used to it." Jared took me out to the local movies one night where I suffered a panic attack because we were seated in the middle of a row and I couldn't handle not being able to get out if the roof collapsed on me. I would have panic attacks in the car if I got stuck in traffic or the light stayed red for too long. The cars around me made me feel claustrophobic. Even going out for dinner was terrible. If the lighting was dim and I was at a busy restaurant, I'd panic that I wouldn't be able to see clearly if a fire started and the place went up in flames. And don't even get me started on going to the MCG to watch a footy game one evening. That was obviously the night. I was certain there would be a terrorist attack and we'd all die in a brutal bombing. These highly irrational thoughts consumed me for many months, resulting in an exhausted mother who wasn't being the best she could for her baby, her husband, and most importantly, for herself. If I had to go out and have Bobby stay at mum's, I'd have an anxiety attack because I wasn't by his side. Things got so bad that I couldn't sleep unless he was sleeping in the bed next to me, and I ended up going on medication to help me with that and to get my sleep back to a somewhat regular pattern. After Floss was born in January 2017, I began to internally struggle with my identity again. What the fuck had I done with my life? I had two kids and I loved them so much that it hurt my soul. Being a mum is what I was made to do. I was a brilliant mother and it came very naturally to me. But as a woman, as Sophie, I was watching all my friends go on these wild adventures, doing Kentucky tours, packing up and moving overseas with exciting job prospects. And it pains me to admit it, but I was having this moment of, I guess I'd almost call it regret. For the first time since becoming a mother at 22, I was overwhelmed with the sense that I was mourning a life I hadn't experienced. My mental health was much better with Florence than it was with Bobby, her being my second child, but still, I'm their mum. I'm always going to be connected to them by a rope. I've had friends who have had kids and still gone overseas, gone off on trips, and they've been perfectly fine to leave their kids at home with Nan while they travelled. I didn't judge these people for doing this, for enjoying some alone time. I envied them because I believed I'd never be able to do it. I remember crying to Jared, explaining that I was missing a part of me I felt had died when I became a mum. "But you can do all of those things, Soph," Jared would say to me. "I'm fully supportive of you doing that. The kids will be fine here with me." I knew that I could. Of course I could. It wasn't a question of whether I could physically go or not, whether Jared would support me if he'd be okay with the kids on his own. It was psychological. I couldn't go. Not because the kids would struggle without me, but because I knew I'd be anxious about being so far away from my children, and it wasn't worth the risk of feeling like that. So there I was, struggling with this very deep, tempestuous identity crisis. I had always been such a brave, independent person, and somehow becoming a mother had made me soft. I felt like I was on the verge of a mental breakdown, day after day, and the pressure I was feeling combined with the guilt of being a bad mother was suffocating. One of my most painful memories is of watching Bobby as he slept one night while he was a baby, my innocent, chubby-faced angel, while I sat there crying and apologizing. "I'm sorry mummy is crazy, baby. I'm sorry. You didn't sign up for this." I was in tears, convinced that the images I'd conjured in my mind of being confined to a psych ward, wrapped in a straitjacket, would soon become a reality. Jared struggled with his own demons for quite some time, too, and I spent years and years trying to get him to understand that. It was brutal to watch someone who had worked so tirelessly, busting his ass and doing everything he possibly could to fulfill his potential within the AFL, have his dreams end so abruptly. After 4 years, the fantasy he'd had since he was a little boy was bluntly cut short, and he was lost with how life looked for him now. As his partner, I was completely shattered for him, devastated that, regardless of his natural talent and commitment to the sport, both physically and emotionally, he was told he wasn't good enough. It was over for him. I saw the pain, the confusion. He was a lost little boy who didn't know what to do. So I did anything and everything I could to assist him and to help him find happiness again, to help him find his place. I agreed to move to Adelaide so he could go back and play with friends in the Sandful, where we as a family could just be us for a while and get everything back on track. I regularly signed him up for short courses that he'd tell me he was interested in, supported his enrollment in a uni course, smiled and nodded every time he would start a new job. But just like he did with all those courses, he would quit after a few months because he didn't like it. He was forever seeking happiness but was never content because he was still mourning a career and a life he had also lost through no choice of his own. I would assure him that it was okay if he needed help, that it was okay if he, in fact, was not okay, that there was a much bigger picture at play here, his role as a father, one he was so bloody brilliant at, and that his son was more important than any game. But Jared is proud, so damn proud, and he could never bring himself to admit his mental struggles. It became damaging for him, for me, and for our family dynamic. He had always helped me through my mental health struggles, and I continually tried to understand how I could best support him too. I left no stone unturned, booking him into psychologist appointments and even ringing his parents to let them know exactly how bad he was at one stage. Why was nothing I was doing helping? Why did he go to his doctor twice and then cancel the rest of his appointments? Why did he laugh at the thought of being put on medication? Why did he continue to tell his dad he was happy, knowing he was lying? It is no secret that mental health battles are horrific. And some of my own experiences, I wouldn't wish upon my worst enemy. Yet not a lot of discussion exists around how fucking debilitating it can also be to try to desperately support someone who doesn't want help. For years, I lived with someone I'd constantly embrace, validate, support, and attempt to motivate, all while trying to stay afloat in my own new role as a mum. I was selfless in that time, but of course, I needed to be. This was my beautiful husband letting go of himself every day before my eyes. But I had no options left. I felt like I'd exhausted every tool I had, and I had to accept that I could no longer help Jared if he didn't want to help himself. But doing so has forever left a scar on my heart. I believe something was triggered in me when my daughter arrived in 2017. Looking back now, I can see that when I birthed Florence, I also birthed her, my true self, at the same time because my whole world changed that year. During those months, I was grappling with my identity crisis while simultaneously developing a growing obsession with the stunning blonde I'd met that fateful night at the AFLW event. I was also facing some home truths about my darling husband. Jared is a beautiful man. He's so accepting, so generous to everyone in life. Just so bloody nice. I cannot fault him in his kindness and his nature. He really was a wonderful husband in many ways, the kind of husband that many would dream of. What I found most attractive was that he was also a natural father. He also took on a lot becoming a dad at 21, and still to this day, I am so proud of him for embracing it with such enthusiasm. Proud of us both as a team. We were a couple for almost a decade, since our teenage years, and during this time we had two gorgeous children and got married smack bang in the middle of it all. But when it comes to everyday things like finances, career, paying the bills, home organisation, life admin, being an adult, I call it, he's slack. Worse than bad. And I know he will laugh at this because even he agrees. Believe me when I say it was really fucking difficult to separate from someone who's so damn nice. Someone who treated me well and who didn't cheat. Someone who treated me with respect and was a great dad. But while nice is great, nice doesn't always make the best partner. Nice is good, but is nice reliable? Does nice always support your emotional and mental needs? Nice doesn't pay the bills. Nice doesn't always drive you to constantly bring out the very best of you. I already had two children, and for a long time, I felt I had a third too. I ran the household finances for the entirety of our relationship. Managing finances hadn't been a strength of either of ours when we met, but I learnt quickly upon cohabiting that I'd have to take the reins if it was going to get done. I knew exactly what date the mortgage was due, how much his phone bill was, what we owed for daycare each fortnight, which medical expenses we'd incurred, and the exact level of health cover we were all entitled to. On occasion, to give him some responsibility, I'd hand him a bill and ask him to pay it. He'd say yes. I'd check in the next day. Babe, did you pay that bill? Yeah, he'd tell me. I did. Then a month later, I'd get the reminder notice. I thought you said you paid the bill. Oh yeah, nah, I forgot. So why did you lie to me when I asked you if you'd paid for it? For all of Jared's wonderful traits, he also had a lack of drive. Something I've never publicly spoken about. Even when I was living as what felt like a caged up, watered down version of myself during my baby's newborn stages, I was still bursting daily with determination, passion, and the desire to really make something of myself against all odds. And I struggled to see a man with so much potential live with such complacency. It may sound trivial to some, but it was exhausting to deal with on a regular basis. I've always wanted to flourish in whatever I was doing, and becoming a young mum only made me more ambitious. I continually wanted to prove to my kids that you can make anything of yourself. But being so goal-oriented, I have a really hard time dealing with people who say but don't do in life. I spent nearly a decade enabling Jared, allowing this somewhat lazy behaviour, and in the end, it burnt me out. Nice wasn't enough. I needed more, and I communicated that to him for years, but nothing ever changed. People are going to think that I was being selfish in saying this. They're going to say I'm ungrateful. But why does a woman have to settle for nice alone? Why was I made to feel like I couldn't want more in my life? You should be happy with what you've got, people said to me while I was staring down the barrel of separation. But why? I deserved more. I can tell you now, on the other side of it all, that nice is perfect to have a co-parenting relationship with. Jared and I have the best thing going on now. If I need a favour, if I need him to pick up the kids, or if I've left Bobby's jacket at his place, he's there in an instant. But I needed more than nice in a forever partner. "You outgrew me," he told me more than once after we split. "I needed to do more. I needed to do better. And I couldn't give that to you." And I couldn't disagree. It was so unfortunate, so sad, because I loved him and he loved me. And I still do to this day. In a different way, obviously, but I do love him. He is my family and he always will be. But he needed to separate too, to find his own happiness. Embracing fatherhood and the commitment of a marriage was second nature to Jared. But he needed to be alone in order to soar, to blossom into the real Jared Charles Keisha. I never wished to fall out of love with him, and I live with such guilt, even now, after being separated for nearly 3 years, that I broke all the promises I made to him on our wedding day. But I wasn't being empowered within my relationship or my home. And towards the end of our marriage, I constantly had to look to myself for my inspiration. Jared knows how much guilt I still hold. Guilt, he says, I don't deserve to feel. Even now, when we discuss these times, I cry hysterically, wondering if there was something more I could have done to hang on. This year, Jared was diagnosed with inattentive ADHD, a form of attention deficit hyperactive disorder that can manifest in a limited attention span, lack of focus, procrastination, and being easily distracted and forgetful. It's been so nice to see him finally gain some clarity around his life and the behaviours he's experienced his entire life. All I would ever want for Jared is complete happiness, and it's been great to see that this diagnosis and the subsequent work he's now putting in to understand it further has allowed him to accept parts of himself that have frustrated him for so long. Chapter 12. Even after Jared and I decided to separate, I was still looking after him. We continued to live together for around 12 months because we wanted a smooth transition for the kids, and we were kind of trialing things out at first. Ending our marriage isn't a decision we made lightly, and we weren't prepared to leap into it without careful planning. Only 3 or 4 close friends knew at the time, but we actually rented a 2-bedroom apartment in 2019 as a way to test the whole separation thing. Our focus was always the children. We wanted their lives to be unimpacted, for them to know no different than their usual family life. So together, we agreed to lease a separate property that we would share usage of. That way, the kids stayed put at home, and we would alternate between who stayed at the apartment solo and who stayed in the house with the kids. We liked that the separation didn't seem too brutal and cutthroat that way, that it wasn't a case of someone moving out and it being so final. We liked the idea of the soft separation, whereby we were able to come and go freely as we liked, also allowing for change of mind with fewer potential ramifications. We set up the apartment together, ordering new beds and furniture, and just like our dynamic now, there was no set routine as to who went there and when. We were each entitled to stay there, generally rotating every second weekend and during the week. If someone felt like they needed a break or wanted some alone time, they headed to the apartment. We'd tell the kids that mummy or daddy was at work, and we never even told our own families about our living arrangements. This apartment not only allowed us each to have our own space and the ability to see other people, but also helped slowly transition the children into a life where they'd be spending time with just one parent at a time, rather than living as a whole family unit. As we always had in the past, we maintained respect for one another and our privacy, never asking questions or probing into each other's private lives, and it worked perfectly for us. After 10 months of trialing the separation, we had made peace with the fact that we would be going our separate ways permanently, another sign of how Jared and I have always been able to maintain honest, open communication, even through the most challenging of experiences. it was time to announce our separation. But let me tell you, breaking up in the public eye is really fucking hard. Leaving the nice guy and then going on to date people of the same sex as you while the world's eyes are on you is even harder, especially when people don't have a clue what's going on behind closed doors. Jared and I had always shared a lot about our life together online, but there was obviously a lot that the public had no idea about. It's crazy to me that people think they know your life, all the ins and outs, from the few minutes a day you share on your Instagram stories. So many people think they know your entire truth based on assumptions and 30-second clips. The online community saw all the fun, beautiful parts of my life with Jared, and that's the couple that they fell in love with, the public version of us. They felt like they knew us intimately, which made announcing our separation even harder. When you reveal something like that after welcoming the public into your life, even if it's not your entire life, they feel like they're owed some sort of explanation. Before we announced it publicly, we obviously told our families. We decided to write a joint text to send out to everyone. It sounds a bit weak, but it was how we wanted to do it, to let everyone know all at once and to put it all into one message so we weren't making a bunch of calls or sending heaps of texts. "We're honestly fine," we shared. "We cannot stress to you enough how good we are. This is something we've been deciding for a while, for over 12 months, not something we just decided last week. Please respect us and this decision. And if you want to talk, please call us. We're not going to ignore you." It was a huge shock for everyone. Well, almost everyone. One of my sisters was aware that we were separating for a while, and I'd told my dad that something was going on. I hinted to him that there were going to be some changes, and I told him I needed him to be accepting, which he was. "As long as everyone is okay, I'll be here," he told me. So my dad and my sister knew that the split was coming, as well as Jared's stepmom, who I'd confided in 6 months prior. Yet for everyone else, it would have appeared to have come totally out of the blue. Everyone thought we were so good, that we were so happy. Jared and I were the couple who always got along better than anyone, so no one could believe that we would split up. The truth was, we were good. We were so happy. We just simply were not going to do that married anymore. My mum, who at times had been quite old school, was actually great with the situation. She invited me around, which was very unlike her, and asked to talk. "What's happened?" she asked, sitting me down and handing me a cup of coffee. "No matter what, I'm here for you, and it's obviously your decision, but I'm just really upset. I thought you and Jared were solid." "Well, Mum, so did I." Once I explained to her the issues we'd been going through, our real-life marital issues, she understood, though she admitted she was very sad about it. But Mum also saw my sadness. The broken heart of a girl who'd fallen out of love with someone she actually never wanted to fall out of love with. By this stage, we'd also publicly announced on Instagram, after months of speculation, and the newspapers and magazines were having a field day guessing at why we'd really split. It seemed that everyone was hoping there was some scandal. They were prying, waiting for one of us to spill. The fact that there were rumours about my sexuality already doing the rounds only added fuel to the fire. Everyone thought they knew the truth, and everyone thought they were entitled to an instant explanation. Who cheated on who? Who has a new partner? Is one of them gay? Are they both gay? Of course, it was never anything as titillating as that. We simply couldn't agree on some life issues. We couldn't come to a resolution on certain things. And we couldn't do it anymore. There were so many things that Jared did and didn't do that drove me to the brink. Shit, Jared probably couldn't handle me fucking crying and screaming at him anymore either. Neither of us was genuinely happy. People refused to believe that two adults could do this so peacefully. So when we announced the separation and then, 6 months later, I was dating a girl, people just knew that was the real reason we'd really split. Eye roll. It felt like the public saw us as characters in a movie, and they didn't like the way our movie had ended, which made them angry. But this was real life. It was my life, and I couldn't live it for anyone else but myself. I even had his mum call me up one day, seeking answers because friends had been calling her. I politely reminded her that it was none of her or their business who I was having sexual relations with, and asked her whether she was questioning her son about the same thing. Now, if people ask me whether I'm gay these days, I actually never say, yes, I'm gay, because I don't want to stick myself in a nice little packaged box. All I know is now I'm in a relationship with a woman. I'm very attracted to females, physically, emotionally, and spiritually. So what does that make me? I've been with men, I've been with women. But what if I dated a guy again one day? What if my relationship didn't work out and then I went on to date a man? Why do we need to label things? Why can't we all just allow people to live and explore life? Once upon a time, I thought I knew who I was. And yes, that was me at that point in time. But when I started exploring, I discovered a different me. And I'm so excited to keep growing and learning more about who I am. No one wanted to believe that we were okay and that our relationship had simply run its course. I'm sure to this day, people still don't believe it, to be honest, and I couldn't give a shit. But when I had family questioning me, both to my face and behind my back, that cut a little deep. They couldn't believe what we'd told them, as if they thought I had to be lying. Jared mustn't be okay with it. How could a man possibly be fine with his ex-wife dating a woman? How could he possibly support her in that? They were almost digging around for the cause of the fight, the reason for this falling out, because then it would make sense to them. The fact that we'd separated without any drama or anger, that we'd figured it out ourselves, they couldn't wrap their heads around it, or the fact that I was dating and that Jared was okay with it. He would tell me everything they said about me. He still does, because to this day, we are best friends. Are you okay? I saw that Daily Mail article about her wanting to fuck women, he recalled his mum saying once, telling me that he told her I had never even spoken to that publication. Oh, well, there were quotes from her in there, his mum said. Never mind the fact they were taken from an interview I did on a podcast 3 months earlier, which Jared also told her. Well, that's fine, he'd said to her. But that's going to affect your relationship with your grandkids because I need you to be okay with Soph, so that if she needs you to pick up the kids from school because she's running late from work or something, I need you to be able to say yes. This is going to affect everyone, and I am not going to let it happen. I still cry over it. I sobbed hysterically to my girlfriend on my son's last birthday because he was another year older, and I was, and I am still weighed down with so much guilt that I've taken our family dynamic apart. One positive that I believe came out of the backlash and the public interest around our split was that I think it made me a better person. It made me even more accepting and non-judgmental of other people's private situations. It's funny, Jared and I are always the people that our friends call when they want an unbiased opinion, a vent, or a shoulder to lean on because they know neither of us have a judgmental bone in our body. If someone I know breaks up with their partner, I'm not interested in the gossip. I don't want to dig around to uncover some scandal. All I think is, I hope they're okay, because I know how tough it is, especially when you live your life in the public eye. Having experienced what it's like to be gossiped about, speculated on, to hear such fabricated versions of events about your marriage and your sex life plastered all over the newspapers and in morbid gossip forums, I'm more accepting than ever of this idea that you never know what someone's going through. Everyone deserves happiness in life, and that includes me and you. The proof I needed that we'd made the right call for both of us came when Jared and I were invited as a couple to his best friend's wedding in Mexico in December 2019, not long after announcing our split. I told him he should go with his brother and I'd stay here with the kids. He hadn't been overseas in ages and it was his best mate who was getting married, so it made sense that he would go. It didn't feel right that we go together at that point, regardless of how amicable everyone knew we were. This was his moment, and I needed to let him go on his own. "Go for 2 weeks," I told him. "Go to New York while you're over there too." "He couldn't go all that way and not make a proper trip out of it," I encouraged him. In the photos I later saw from that trip, I saw a smile on Jared's face I hadn't seen in years. He was himself in those moments. He was back to being Jared Keisha, travelling New York City with his brother, living again. Although the emotion from announcing our separation was still fresh, I could not have been happier. I could tell he was starting to come back. And this is when I knew that, for the both of us, life was only just beginning. Chapter 13. I think I was a feminist before I even knew what feminism was. Why are we conditioned to believe that we can't be happy unless we have a partner? That if one is alone, even by choice, that they are not complete? When Netflix released Bridgerton, a story of love, wealth, and passion in Regency-era England, I was riddled with both anxiety and frustration at how relatable some of those storylines were to practices that somehow still exist today. Set back in the early 1800s, Bridgerton centres around debutantes, young girls dressed beautifully, paraded around a court so that they can find a husband, or more specifically, so that the men can handpick their bride, with little to no say from the women themselves. Women were considered successful if they were lucky enough to be chosen to be a wife and would heap gratitude and praise on the suitor and his family. It made me sick that 200 years later, the message that a woman should show gratitude towards a man for the honour of giving you his love is still prominent, if more subtle these days. I am disgusted that, as a 17-year-old, I'd partaken in what my school called a debutante ball, a coming-out party for the young ladies of society to be presented to the public wearing long, flowing white dresses as a sign of purity, innocence, and virginity. At the time I partook in my deb ball, I had no idea what it really meant or that the practice has its roots in rituals from hundreds of years ago, when women were basically sold off to the highest bidder and were pitied, even shunned, if no man wanted them. Author Glennon Doyle unpacks this theme of gratitude in her book Untamed brilliantly, dissecting this notion that women are always told how grateful they should be in life. If you find a man that loves you and is nice enough to marry you, be grateful. If you have kids and you are blessed with motherhood, please be grateful. And definitely do not ask for more. Yet something I discovered over the years is that you can be both grateful and unsatisfied simultaneously. Being grateful does not mean you need to settle. You can absolutely be thankful in life and still not be satisfied, whether that's in your relationship, friendships, parenthood, or career. I was told to be grateful because I had a nice, kind husband, one who loved me and cared for me, a man that still does both of those things. As if my only purpose in life as a woman was to seek fulfillment through the way I am treated by another human. Nothing to do with what I want individually or what my soul sought in the pursuit of happiness. I recall chatting to Jared's nan one afternoon over a cuppa about a couple she knew who was splitting up. Jared's nan, a delightful woman, but very old school, with traditional Catholic values. "If anything ever happens with you and Jared and you think you're going to leave, come talk to me first and I'll talk you out of it," she told me. That's just her generation, and I will not fault her for that. She wasn't taught any different and still upheld the notion that a successful life relied heavily on a marriage. Not necessarily a stable, loving, committed relationship, but the title of marriage. That's what society viewed as success, presumed would bring happiness. But the times have changed now. We can be taught differently, and we can teach the next generation to do things differently too. As a society, we like to think that we are progressive, yet the fact that deadballs still occur is fucking wild to me. Like seeking partners and stable commitment, women are also meant to want to have children, because that's a woman's purpose, right? And by being in a relationship and by producing babies, you will find yourself in a position of utter bliss and fulfillment, correct? Ludicrous. It's always been natural to me to want